New casinos in the New York City area, an expansion of sports gambling, and the development of online poker are all being considered by state lawmakers, hoping to raise revenues to fund New York's operating expenses in the future. But before the state embarks on these endeavors, State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli issued a new report calling for a closer look at how the existing, as well as any future gambling offerings, contribute to problem gambling and whether enough is being done to support New Yorkers at risk of potentially ruining their lives by gambling. The Comptroller joined us Tuesday morning to discuss the report, as well as his latest budget forecast, oversight of state spending, and much, much more. Welcome back to the show, Comptroller.
David, great to be back with you.
So you note in your report that the state brings in billions of dollars annually from gambling in New York, I believe $3.7 billion for the previous fiscal year.
Yeah.
How does that compare to what the state invests in services dealing directly with problem gambling?
Well, you know, I mean, this is an issue that we've raised in the past. And, you know, while certainly there have been some efforts to improve the way that the Office of Addiction Services and Supports deals with this issue, it is a paltry percentage compared to the billions that are being spent, but even more so, you know, when you look at the money being spent on marketing. If you are trying to increase revenue by, in effect, encouraging, you know, more people to participate in the various kinds of gaming and gambling, you really are going to make worse for certain individuals and certain families the problem of addiction to gambling. And we know it can ruin lives. We know it can ruin families. And so our concern continues to be, you know, what kind of analysis are you putting on the effectiveness of programs? How can you dedicate more resources? You know, it really needs to be a priority, especially if you're going to be looking for opportunities to expand the gaming.
In the past, the administration has also been faulted for the way it determines how it actually spends some of this money addressing problem or compulsive gambling. Is there any indication of how the state determines where it's going to allocate its resources, whether it says, you know, I'm going to set up a clinic to help people near a casino? I mean, do we know how they decide to allocate these resources?
Well, they are embarking on a broader analysis and study, and this, you know, part of that was in response to an audit that we did back in 2019 on this issue. But some of that information is still being developed, and they really do need to target it more. It really is a question of striking a balance. I mean, you mentioned the billions of dollars that are involved with this whole industry, but you're talking about $5.7 million being spent on, you know, treatment and recovery services. It is a tiny fraction, and I guess the better comparison really, you know, is to the marketing, right? So, you know, with gaming, there's a lot of money generated, a lot of money goes to prizes, you know, a lot to weigh. But you look at, you know, $90 million spent on marketing for the lottery as an example, and $5.7 million spent on the treatment and recovery. It just, the balance is way out of whack. So they are doing greater analysis. They are, you know, making assessment of even location of the kind of services that could be available. I mean, New York is, you know, it's a big state, and you want to make sure from a geographic perspective that there is a distribution of programs that are available for people who may need the services. So that's the kind of analysis that, you know, they are embarking on. They've done some of that work, but they really do need to do more on it. And I think part of what we're asking for is that they, on an annual basis, give us information, give us updates as to what kind of activity, what kind of resources are they allocating to deal with prevention and treating of problem gambling, and what, you know, how much money is being spent. And do that, you know, not when we do an audit, but do it as part of a regular reporting. And we would suggest that should be an annual report.
There's activities in New York like daily fantasy sports, which are, from my perspective, tantamount to gambling, but are specifically not called gambling and not treated that way by the legislature and Cuomo, and that has to do partially with constitutional questions. But the framing issue, does that, and I guess more generally just calling gambling gaming, does that potentially lower the stakes around gambling, enabling people to almost get sucked in by the fact that it's treated as, I guess, lower stakes than what gambling can involve?
That's an interesting question. I mean, perhaps, but I also think people have a lot of common sense, you know, so they kind of know what it is. It's a chance. Probably not likely to make you rich, but you know, I think people, you know, whether it's the lottery or going to OTB or, you know, going to a casino, I think people kind of get what it, you know, what it's all about. So I, you know, you may be right if someone's trying to rationalize, as often people do, right, especially if they have a problem. But I think most people, common sense tells you it's all part of the same. It's all part of the same picture.
Is there any type of gambling that you enjoy?
Running for office probably would be the best example.
I don't know. That's a pretty safe
bet. The gambling
bet
that I enjoy.
Years.
You know, fortunately, the odds have worked in my favor most of the time, but not every time. But no, I mean, look, every now and then when the jackpot is really huge, I'll get tempted and I'll do Powerball or something like that. But I'm not a regular partaker of of any of that activity.
I see in Saratoga Springs when we have the races occasionally, but is that just a pop-in, not necessarily combing through the program for the next pick three?
I have a very inartful approach. I will, if I'm there at the track, I'll look at some of the races and I'll bet maybe in one or two of them. And sometimes it'll be either I like the name of the horse, or I may know the owner, or it's a New York horse. Or what I actually do, Dave, to be honest with you, is that I usually will not take any great risk, and I will do, like $2 or $4 to place. I don't usually gamble on the winner. I say, let me go for place. At least that's a more conservative approach. And the result is I have not made very much money whenever I placed a bet like that.
We're speaking with the Capital Press Room's professional handicapper, Tom Napoli, who also serves as state comptroller. Pivoting slightly, earlier this month, you also put out a report dealing with the state's projected finances. And the big takeaway for me was that you're expecting more in state revenues than the governor is for this fiscal year, nearly, I think, $4 billion in additional revenues. Why the discrepancy? Do you guys just have calculators, and Budget Director Robert Mojica's only has an abacus for his office? What's the deal?
I think it would be fair to say, we were looking at the most updated numbers, just for September, another $1 billion came in higher than projections. So we just think the trends are more positive. I think when the budget office whenever they do their next update, my guess is that will reflect, some of the positive trends that, that we're seeing. So look, it doesn't mean we're out of the woods. We're still seeing a budget gap. For this year, even with these better numbers of, $8 billion, you're still seeing major challenges managing the cash flow, which is, something that the Governor Division of Budget is doing right now. And I certainly, even though our numbers came in more optimistic, we're still down from last year, and we're still very much in need of that additional federal help that many of us have been calling for and that we still are waiting for.
Maybe I'm cynical here, and this is kind of a recurring theme here, but I wonder if, is it possible that the governor's numbers, which are, like we say, more doom and gloom than your forecast, which is still not super great, could his framing of this be a way to potentially leverage more relief from D.C. if and when another stimulus comes around and they say, look at New York, boy, they really need help, as opposed to the comptroller's numbers, which say maybe they need a little less help?
Well, I mean, look, budgeting and revenue and spending, you need to track it on a regular basis, and that's something we do. It's great when you can report on what the spending and the revenue was for the month before. When you're trying to project, 1 month, 6 months, a year from now, especially when you're going through the kind of crisis time that we're going through right now, it is very much more of an art than a science. So, I think that our numbers, we stand by them. I think they're a bit more current, and I think they are based on the fact that when you look at some of the national economic forecasts earlier in the year showed, much less positive economic activity, contraction rather than growth. But, what you're seeing is nationally a tremendous amount of resilience in the economy. New York is benefiting from some of that to a degree. But, certainly you have to recognize, I mean, we're a big state, but New York City's economy is still a very key part of the state's economic engine. And New York City is suffering on many levels in terms of their economy. So, you know, so the bottom line is that none of this is precise. All of this is fragile because if we do get a true second wave, and obviously there have been some spikes in the coronavirus that we've seen recently, but if we get a true second wave, even our more optimistic numbers, you'll throw them out the window. Because if the economy goes back into, in effect, you know, a hold, a pause, a lockdown, whatever you call it, you know, you're going to see, a reverse in those more optimistic numbers that we had, and we make that clear in the report. And we're in our report, and this should point out, this was part of that quick start process that we're required to do, every November, where the controller, the governor, the legislature are supposed to come up with their reports, and we're very strict about meeting that deadline. But you know, we make clear, depending on what happens with the pandemic, these numbers could change, and we did not anticipate that there would be additional federal help. So to me, when and if, and I think it's more when than if, there will be more federal stimulus and relief, the question will be how much and how will that improve our situation. But David, let me just end on this point. We still are facing some very tough choices as we move beyond this year, you know, certainly the next 2 or 3 years. It's going to take a while for us to get back to the kind of revenues that we had pre-pandemic. So anybody that reads too much of a silver lining out in our report, they're making a mistake. And even with additional federal help, I'm sure it won't be everything that we would like. Tough choices on spending, tough choices on taxes, tough choices on borrowing. That's going to be confronting all of us in New York.
And after a quick break, we'll continue our conversation with State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli, including a discussion about investments into fossil fuel companies by the state's pension fund and his election plans for the future.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.
We're continuing our conversation with State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli. Back in January, you announced that your office was reviewing the actions of some coal companies that are under your investments, the state's pension fund. And I was curious how that process went, and more broadly, what you're thinking about the issue of divestment from fossil fuel companies with the state pension fund as we move forward in New York trying to accomplish a lot of green goals through our climate change legislation that we passed in 2019, which call for drastic reductions in greenhouse gas emissions in New York.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I look at the issue in terms of the risk of climate change. And certainly as a person living on the planet, I'm concerned about that in terms of the health and well-being of the planet. As trustee for the pension fund, my concern is the risk to our portfolio or investment. And I do think that climate change is a material risk to the portfolio, and we need to assess that. And we have been assessing that for a number of years, part of our environment, social, and governance analysis that we do on all of our investments. We've been very thoughtful about this issue. So again, I think to talk about the issue just in terms of fossil fuel companies, you're missing the broader challenge of climate and other sectors that you need to have an analysis. So as you know, we've talked about it before in your show, we convened an advisory panel along with the governor of experts, no political agenda, to make some recommendations, and they did. It did not include just wholesale divestment of fossil fuel holdings that we have, but to have a thoughtful strategy. And we developed a climate action plan in response to that, where we're developing minimum standards for our investments, where we double the amount of money we are putting in our proactive climate solutions and sustainable investing program. And we've been looking at different sectors. So as you mentioned, we we started with coal companies. We set minimum standards. We had a thoughtful analysis. We engaged with the companies because we do think engagement with companies, pressing them to do the right thing, is important. And that did result in the divestment of about 20-some-odd coal companies that we had holdings in, because we made a judgment that it was a risky investment, you know, in terms of where that industry was headed, and that the companies were not coming up with alternative strategies about how to stay profitable and be consistent with the goals of the Paris Agreement. So the next sector that we're looking at now is on tar sands, oil sands. So we've identified a number of companies that we're now going through that process. We're setting minimum standards. We're engaging with the companies. Again, the issue for us is we're moving towards a low-carbon economy. And I'm pleased with President Biden coming in. We're going to rejoin Paris. I think that the Paris Agreement is very important. So the companies we invest in, how are you developing plans to be profitable in a low-carbon economy? How are you developing business plans that are consistent with the goals of the Paris Agreement, because climate risk and global warming must be dealt with? So the issue of transition ready is key to us. And what you're seeing with some of the European fossil fuel companies, they get it better than the American companies. They are putting more money into renewables, into wind and solar and so on. And we would like to see more of the American companies do that. We've had engagements in that area. So we're continuing a thoughtful process in this regard. So we've done some divestments. We've certainly been announcing our increased investments in climate solution and green strategies. You know, I think our approach is one that addresses the issue of climate, but recognize that we're a pension fund, right? We didn't cause climate risk, and selling stock is not going to solve it. But you know, we know it's an issue of risk that we have to deal with, and I actually think we've been a leader in this area. We're not doing slogans. I got 1.1 million New Yorkers who depend on retirement security from our pension fund. We have a lot of taxpayers that are concerned about how we finance those pensions as well. So we don't want the pension fund to become a political football. We don't want the independence of our investment strategy to be compromised, frankly, by a legislative mandate on where we can and can't invest money. That would be, I think, a very bad precedent for managing the pension fund, for that management not to be handled by the investment professionals that are working for fund, instead to be debated on the floor of the state legislature. That's not the place to make pension fund decisions.
There was one analysis, though, of some of the oil and gas stocks back in March that you guys have investments in, and they, this green group, argued that some of these companies were ultimately losing money for the pension fund. Do you feel like the investments in the fossil fuel companies are paying dividends for the pension people that you need to pay out in New York?
Well, by paying dividends, you don't mean paying dividends.
No.
I mean, they are paying dividends.
I mean,
it's interesting. Some of them keep the dividends up no matter what. You know, which is a plus. Look, you know, a couple of quick thoughts on that. Some of the green groups, they do come up with those analyses. Those groups that are funded by the oil and gas industry, they come up with the opposite analysis, that in fact you make money with this. So, you know, somewhat the source of the study tends to dictate the outcome of the analysis. Again, keep in mind, we are a $220+ billion investment fund. Our public equities, the stocks, the kind of stocks we're talking about, are largely invested through index funds that are broadly invested across all sectors of the economy, not just for a month, you know, a year, for you know, for decades. And so the kind of index funds that we have, in some years, certain stocks go up. Some years, certain stocks go down. But there's always this debate in the larger investment world. Are you better off doing passive investing, where you just ride the market over a long period of time, or you do active management? You say, well, this stock isn't doing good, so I'm going to sell it today. If it does good next year, I may buy it again. I mean, look, if we had all of our money in Amazon, right, you know, for the past 2 years, we'd be doing wonderful. But that is a risky proposition, to bet on stocks that look good today. When the dot-com bubble burst, you know, back, you know, around 2000, you know, a lot of folks pulled out of tech. You know, we didn't, again, because we stayed broadly invested. And look how tech came roaring back. Are the oil and gas stocks very stressed right now and not doing as well? Absolutely. But the energy sector as a whole is still a part of the investment strategy that the, you know, most of the index funds are still have exposure to. So to kind of short-term analysis, you know, unless you're going to become just an active bettor on stocks, where frankly we would lose the advantage of the cost effectiveness of passive investing through index funds, we'd have to have a huge staff or pay high fees to do just active management. Yeah, there are always going to be winners or losers, but we're a pension fund. You know, we're investing, you know, for people who are going to retire 25, 30 years from now. We're not investing with the horizon of, well, I'm going to retire in 2 or 3 years. I better make sure, you know, all my bets are really the best bets. So, I think people sometimes don't realize what our investment strategy is, and there are always going to be winners or losers in the stock market, but a big part of our portfolio is just going to bet on the market over time, you know, growing, and I think that bet has paid off well. A bet is probably the wrong term since we were talking about gambling earlier, but that decision, that judgment has paid off. We're one of the best funded state pension plans in the country. That's not new. That's been the history in New York for a long period of time, and we're working hard to maintain that.
It's pretty clear that the Democrats in the legislature, some of whom you endorsed, will make up healthy majorities in 2021. What would you like to see them pass with their amassed power?
Well, look, I mean, I think clearly the first challenge from our perspective in this office, you know, putting aside the very important issue of COVID-19 that we're all going to have to deal with, is I really hope that, you know, how do I say this in the appropriate way, as someone who was a 20-year legislator and now controller for a number of years, the legislative process, as vibrant as it is, tends to lend itself to a very short-term view of things. How do we get this budget done for the coming year? How do we close out, you know, the session? What often has been missing, regardless of who's in control of the legislature, is taking that longer-term view. And I think because we are in a crisis right now, health and financial, I would hope that the legislature, working with the governor, would really try to incorporate a longer-term view of how we manage all these issues. And certainly from our perspective, that includes budget balance. Look, before the pandemic, you know, we had a budget gap we had to deal with, and we had out-year gaps. We had structural gaps in our state's financial plan that have been there for years. And yet we always seem to get through it, right, because we figure out how to close the gap for the coming year. But I think this time of crisis should teach us that you don't know when the next crisis is around the corner. We need to do a better job of discipline, of matching our recurring revenue with our recurring spending. That creates a lot of opportunities to, you know, to manage how you're going to do that, what your priorities are. But I really would hope that a you know, from a budgetary and long-term fiscal health for the state perspective, the priority really should start to be not just looking at closing the current year budget gap or the next year budget gap, but what are we doing to make decisions today that are going to put us on a path to fiscal balance 2 years, 3 years, 4 years down the road. And you know, a lot of choices will be made on spending, taxes, and borrowing within that broad equation. But we really have not done an adequate job of striking the balance. And I think that's why in a year like this, where everything went haywire, we really found ourselves in a difficult – that's part of why we found ourselves in a difficult situation, and we still are in. Again, we need that more help from Washington to repair the economic damage that came as a consequence of COVID-19, because the alternatives of having to do it all by spending cuts, raising taxes, borrowing, some combination of the three, very painful at a time that we need recovery, not more pain.
Now that Election Day is about 2 weeks in our rearview mirror, I'm looking forward about 720 days to Election Day 2022. You mentioned that you've been pretty successful with those bets on yourself when it comes to running for office. Will you be on the ballot again in 2022 for state controller on the Democratic Party?
I hope to. I hope to be on the Democratic line. I hope to be on the Working Families Party line, as I've been before, and I was pleased that they were able to make the threshold on this go-around. this job as state controller is an outstanding opportunity to serve the public. We have a good team, and you know, we've been the steady hand for a number of years through a number of governors and a number of legislative changes. Knock wood, I'm knocking my head. You know, health wise, I'm doing fine, and I can't think of a better state to be a part of or a better government service to provide than continuing as state controller.
Well, we've been speaking with the state controller, Tom DiNapoli. Controller, thank you so much for making the time. I really appreciate it, and see you next year at the Saratoga Racecourse.
Great. Thanks a lot, David. Great to be with you.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by Destiny USA. Shopping, dining, and entertainment all in one location. For more information, go to www.destinyusa.com.